Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit the website anytime you like. It's rte.ie/Mooney. So, another very busy programme ahead of us here on Mooney Goes Wild this Monday night. And I've got a bevy of beauties with me on the programme today. Aidan's not available this weekend. She's not here. She's the real beauty. But I've got a bevy of beautiful bird watchers. Now, I was doing some research before the programme and I was curious to know how many bird watchers there are in the world. And the figure thrown back at me was 16 million bird watchers, or people who claim to be bird watchers. Could this be true? Are there not more than 16 million bird watchers out of a world population of 8 point something billion people on the planet? Anyway, there are 10,000 birds, give or take. So that makes about 1,600 people for every bird. Imagine if they all wanted to see the same bird at the same time. There'd be a massive crush. And if they all came to Ireland to see the birds, what would happen? Would we just sink? Would there be a big sinkhole where Ireland is on the globe? Who knows? Anyway, so today's programme is all about birds. And we're loosely calling it Mooney Goes Wild Talking Birds. So some of Ireland's greatest ornithologists are with me today in Malahide in North County Dublin. We've got Dr. Richard Collins. Richard, you've been interested in birds all your life, have you not?
I have indeed, Derek. I've been fascinated by birds all my life since I was very young. I began off as an egg collector, and I was very careful, only took one egg with a spoon out of each nest, and I built up a nice collection of eggs. In those days, we didn't have cheap Japanese binoculars. They changed everything. But I was a bird watcher all these years, and I've never lost it, and it still fascinates me now.
Where did you get your keen interest in birds? Who passed it on to you, or was it something you just took up yourself?
It was a sort of an odd thing to be interested in, but there was a teacher in school, a Father Trodden, William Trodden, a Jesuit, and he spotted these kind of interests in people, and he started to cultivate this, to encourage me in this, you see. Support. He was an adult endorsing this activity, which was slightly off the wall and odd and lonely and the sort of thing that reclusive kind of children do. I wasn't a bit reclusive, but he did encourage me, and his insights are still with me today.
All right, so there are your credentials, so to speak. Now, with me in studio is Niall Hatch, Public Relations and Development Officer with Birdwatch Ireland, but he's also a regular panellist on Mooney Goes Wild. Before I ask you about your interest in birds, Niall, can we just qualify for our listeners that collecting eggs, Richard is showing his age there, is now illegal. You cannot do it.
No, it used to be a very widespread practice, and of course there were far more birds back then. No offence, Richard, when you were a child, but in the 1950s it was outlawed in Ireland, so it is illegal now. So when I grew up as a young child in the 1980s watching birds, and egg collecting was very much frowned on and illegal. And thankfully today it no longer occurs, except by very rarely some illegal criminals doing this, but it's thankfully been stamped out.
So do not do it. Now, Niall, where did your love of birds come from?
I don't remember a time when I haven't been fascinated by birds. My mother tells me that it started when I was a toddler, less than 2 years old. I was fascinated with talking to the ducks in the park, not just feeding them, but I wanted to get out of my pushchair, I wanted to go over to them, and I wanted to have conversations in baby talk, whatever I was doing that. I was
quack, fascinated. Quack.
Quack, quack, and they would come over and talk to me. And apparently I just used to watch them coming and going from the window. I remember as a young child having a robin coming and take food from my hand, which was a seminal moment for me. I remember going with my father to see my first ever peregrine falcons at their nest in County Wexford when I was very, very small, and that really stuck with me as well. So I don't really remember a time when I wasn't into birds. I became a member of Birdwatch Ireland when I was around 7. And I remember my mother telling me as well that when I was 5 I had chicken pox and I was at home, and there was an old copy of the Observer's Book of Birds, or the Observer Book of Birds, in the house. They knew I liked birds, so I was reading through this, and within a couple of days I knew all the different Latin names of all of the birds in this book. And I remember my late father telling me he was very impressed that I knew even at that age that the P at the start of ptarmigan was silent. So that's not bad for a 5-year-old.
Yes, ptarmigan is spelled P-T-A-R-M-I-G-A-N. And what is a ptarmigan?
It's a type of grouse. We don't have them here in Ireland. There is a population of them in the Scottish Highlands, and they're found in cold areas and in high mountain regions across the Northern Hemisphere. So it's related to our red grouse, but they turn white in the winter, and a bird that you think of in very cold weather or very high altitude.
So let's move on now to Cove in County Cork and say hello to our man in Cork. It's Jim Wilson. Hello, Jim. How are you?
Hello, Derek. How are you doing?
So your love of birds, where did it come from?
I've got a very bad memory.
Oh dear.
And but I do know from a very early age I was fascinated by any books with pictures of wildlife, particularly African wildlife, comes to mind. And then as time went on, you had Eamon de Butler and Gerrit van Gelderen, which started appearing on television. And a couple of friends of mine at school actually wanted to go bird watching, which back in the very early 1970s was neither profitable nor popular. But it gave me a chance to actually go and look at real wildlife for the first time in any detail. And my dad gave me a loan of his binoculars. And off out we went, and it was like a duck to water, as they would say. And I never look back. My first notebook, I still have it from the age of 12, which is hilarious, but the way I've written it and that. But it was the start of a lifelong love for birds and all things wild.
And did you pass it on to your boys?
Indirectly, Peter, the older one, definitely was interested and used to come along. Barry, the younger one, he made a profession out of doing the opposite to Peter. So he once told me the only birds he liked were ones he could eat. and that was specifically, I think, he was thinking hard of a way of really kind of getting at me, you know.
And, oh, really?
But now I'm telling you, he comes to me about birds on the feeder that he has, and insects and that he's seeing around. And I think, you know, like all of us, you can't escape your parents, believe it or not, I think, whether you like it or not. And it eventually comes out, and it has on both of them, which is lovely.
Well, I've asked you all to join the programme today and bring some stories with you, because I kind of thought, wouldn't it be nice to just dedicate an hour or so to birds? So, Jim, let's start with you as we're speaking with you now. You've got a couple of stories for me.
I have. And the first one relates to Harper's Island. We've covered it before, a lovely Harper's Island Wetlands Nature Reserve here in Cork Harbour. And what we're noticing at the moment is the wetland birds are starting to build up in numbers. Red shanks are in. There's even a few godwits, black-headed gulls, 700-800 of them out there at the moment. And this is the beginning of the end of the breeding season for these wetland birds. Ireland has plenty of wetland birds breeding here on the island of Ireland, but the majority of the birds we see on wetlands in the winter are actually from beyond our shores. And one place in particular, which I've been lucky enough to visit many, many times, is Iceland. And the red shanks we are now seeing on the reserve are back from Iceland. The first ones to come back are generally non-breeding birds. These are birds that flew to Iceland last spring and tried to breed. And for various reasons, either they were unlucky, they were unfit, predators on the ground, whatever, they failed. And once you fail as a red shank in your breeding season, that's the end of it. You don't usually try and start all over again.
Why not? And why wouldn't you try again?
I think the problem is, if you lose an egg in the first couple of days, it has been shown that they will start again. But if you've got your clutch of eggs laid, four eggs or so, and you've been sitting on them for a while, and maybe something like an Arctic fox predates them, or a tractor comes along, something happens, and you lose all the eggs. Starting at that stage is actually too late to get your chicks reared in time to leave Iceland before winter sets in. And so most birds then, for that reason, we think anyway, that seems to be the logical explanation from the observations, they decide, nothing more for me to do here, I'm going to head back to my non-breeding ground, or what we call the wintering grounds, and that includes Ireland. And so those birds generally arrive first. And this is all general, you know, mm-hmm. You can never say never in nature. Then usually it's followed by often the adults, and then the young birds will come as well. It varies from species to species. But by the time we get into November-ish, there will be at least a million birds having been born in Iceland this summer who will spend the winter in Ireland, and some of them will move on to Britain and onto the continent.
A million
as well.
Birds?
Yeah, yeah.
Are you
yeah.
sure?
I'm dead sure if you add them all up. There's even I read a suggestion that you may even get a million snipe alone.
Just one species?
Yeah, if you go, but like these figures, it's so hard to gauge them, to be honest, because when we do our winter counts, which we do every winter, the iWebs counts, we would never find a million. But if you add up the ones that arrived, stay a while, you know, move on through, come back, they've used Ireland either as their base or as a stepping stone, which is why it's so important for these birds. But yeah, it's a huge number of birds. And of course, the young ones are not experienced. And so quite a percentage of them will die in their first winter. They're not as clued in to predators and hunting and finding a good place and that. So you're going to get that as well. But yeah, but the bottom line anyway, whatever the figures are, the numbers are hugely significant for these species at a European, at an international level. And so places like Harper's Island and all the estuaries around Ireland, luckily we're a small country, there isn't an estuary or a wetland too far from anybody on the island, will play host to these birds that will stay here for the winter. Of course, my friends in Iceland say they're not Irish birds, even though they spend most of their life in Ireland, because they were born in Iceland. So they're Icelandic birds. So we can argue that one too. But everything's starting to happen now. We're noticing the birds starting to arrive back after their breeding seasons further north.
And we know these birds come from Iceland. I have been with you. Richard was there also to Iceland when you were actually ringing black-tailed godwits. So just tell our listeners again how we know these birds have come from Iceland to Ireland.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real simple piece of science that was used to do these studies and is still being used for this long term. I think it's nearly 30 years we've been studying them now. And it's basically putting a series of plastic colour rings on these birds' legs. Luckily, black-tailed godwits are beautifully long, slim, elegant birds with very long legs. So it means we can comfortably put these collar rings onto their legs. And we put two on each leg usually. And we can then vary the colours. And the mathematicians listening in can work out how many combinations of colours can you put on these birds that are unique using 8 colours and 4 rings per bird. It's quite a few. And then that makes it unique. We don't put the same combination on 2 birds. And then we rely on bird watchers. Some of the, I think you said, was it 16 million bird watchers around
the
world?
Well, that's the figure I was given. Yeah, Niall wants to dispute that, and we can come back to that in a moment. So, but go ahead, Jeff.
So would I, and we'll talk about that in a bit. But anyway, we ask them to look out for these birds, record the colouring combinations, and let us know. And then we can link that back to the information we have of where we caught it, where we put the rings on, and then throughout its life, follow it. And we've been following some of these birds for over 25 years, which does prove that the rings do not interfere significantly with them going about their business. And they go back to Iceland every summer, raise a family, and then travel. We've learned amazing things like the male and the female of a couple don't always spend the winter together. They split up. They can be up to 1,000 kilometres apart for the winter, and they can arrive back on the breeding grounds to exactly the same field they were in last year within 3 or 4 days of each other. And not a wristwatch between them or a mobile phone to tell them what time it is.
Or a sat-nav device.
Or a sat-nav.
It's built in the case of the birds. And you're talking about birds which make huge migrations. And if you just think of the amount of energy that's required to get those birds off the ground and get them here to Ireland. And I don't think they land on the ocean on journey, do they?
No, they don't. They don't do that at all. They can swim if they have to, but they generally try to avoid deep water. They like paddling around in the shallows. I mean, their cousins, the bar-tailed godwit, was one of the most famous examples of tracking these birds across the Pacific, doing approximately 1,000 kilometres a day for 7, 8 or 9 days non-stop. Phenomenal, putting on weight, putting on fat before they leave as fuel. Nearly 50% of their body weight, they increase it with this fat to fuel their long flight across the Pacific. The godwits don't have to go so far. And there's another one that I've seen recently in a science magazine about the great snipe, which is a cousin of the common snipe that we get here in Ireland. And they've just discovered that they do up to 6, 7, 8,000 kilometres in 2 to 4 days. And they have been clocked at altitudes of over 8,000 metres. during that flight.
8,000 metres or 8,000 feet?
8,000 metres, nearly as high as Mount Everest. And temperatures as low as minus 21 or 22 degrees.
Well, how now does a bird survive at minus 22 degrees?
Well, to be honest, we're not 100% sure, because the physiological requirements, if you're spending the majority of your time at ground level like we do, I mean, you can imagine when you hear about people going to Mount Everest base camp and they're feeling shortness of breath. And I know I've been to altitude. I've been to about 15,000 feet. And I know Richard has been up there too. And boy, does it affect you. It can really affect you. In fact, it can kill some humans. And yet these birds are going, the equivalent of going right to the top of Mount Everest without oxygen, without any additional, without fancy clothes to wear or anything like that. And they pop up and they stay up there during the day, and they found at night they come down. Now, most of them are traveling, like they're moving along at somewhere between 50 and 90 kilometers an hour. They're absolutely belting along. And yet during the day, they go up to an average height of about 4,000 meters. And then during the night, they come down to an average of about 2,000 meters.
So they're sleeping on the wing, you reckon?
Well, you see, this is a whole other discussion we could have, that the sleep in birds, and I think you've covered it occasionally in the programme, is so much different. It's not sleep like us, where you hop into bed and close your eyes and out you go for, you know, 6, 7, 8 hours. They rest parts of the brain as they go. So they shut down bits and they leave open bits. I always use the analogy when I'm teaching in schools, daydreaming. We've all daydreamed, you know, and you're there in class and the poor teacher's trying to teach Irish grammar or algebra or something, and you're daydreaming. You're kind of switched off. But if the teacher says no homework, you're wide awake. You're right there.
Yeah, you're tuned into what
because,
you want to hear. Yeah, it's important.
Because that's exactly that is vital to your existence. And it's the same with the snipe. They can switch off parts of the brain, give it a rest, and still manage to keep flying and keep moving.
But Jim,
just phenomenal.
It is phenomenal. And recently we made a documentary, and thanks to Niall for his help, about eiderduck. And we spoke about eiderdown, being the most expensive down on the planet. You can pay anything up to 15 or 20,000 euro for a double quilt stuffed with eiderdown. I mean, these birds live in extreme cold and they do really well. Now, here you're talking to me about the snipe that can travel up in the sky 4,000 metres. Multiply that by three. What's that? 12,000, 20,000 feet. What is it? How do you multiply it? What's 4,000 metres?
Multiply by three to get old money. So 4,000 metres, roughly 12,000 to 14,000 feet. And that's the average.
And what do ducks fly at 4,000 feet when they're migrating or something like that? Surely we want the down from the actual snipe, not the eiderdown.
See, the thing is, Derek, the difference between the eider and the snipe is the snipe spends almost 8 months of its life in sub-Saharan Africa, places like the Congo. If you've got eider down on you, you're going to die of exhaustion, of heat exhaustion within a couple of days. The eider primarily need that, not so much for their migration, which may be the case to a degree, but they're happy spending the winter in very cold places. Whereas the snipe, again, we don't know. I mean, they put on fat before they go, so it's quite likely they're using the fat to power what you'd call central heating. I mean, the outer layer of feathers in birds is so beautifully designed to retain heat when they need it, to keep the feathers all close together, and they have this lovely kind of, you know, sort of layer of air in between. And if they're burning a lot of energy and they're able to efficiently insulate themselves, they can keep themselves warm at altitude. That would be my reading up.
Well, I've just got some information to say that a jet aircraft over Nevada struck a mallard, wait for it, at an altitude of 21,000 feet, the highest documented flight by a North American waterfowl ever. Niall, you were going to say something, sorry.
It's really interesting that this information is coming out now about the birds, because of course up until now we haven't had the technology to know anything about great snipe and how high they fly, and still we've a lot to learn about other species of bird as well, because if you think about it, they do this without us ever witnessing it. So it's only with this technology we can put on their legs that we're able to do it. Now, these little these trackers they have on the birds that measure all these, the sensors, I suppose, that measure all these altitudes and temperatures and everything, they weigh about 1.5 grams, give or take. And that's a significant amount of weight for a small bird. It's about 1% of the body weight of a great snipe. But if you're looking at a bird that maybe is 20 grams, 25 grams, as many of our migrant birds might be, some of the smaller warblers and so on, we still don't have technology that's small enough to go on those birds. You know, a heavy weight would be a hindrance to them. They might not survive the migration. It wouldn't be ethical to do it. It'd be counterproductive as well. So there's lots of discoveries going to be made, I would say, over the next few years and decades about the incredible things that birds do. Because we know that biologically, birds exist in a wider range of temperatures than any other organisms on the planet. They really are incredible. They go from the coldest parts of the world right to the hottest parts of the world. And it's amazing because feathers, of course, are wonderful insulators, and that works both ways. It keeps them warm when it's cold, but it also keeps them cool when it's warm.
So it's like a flask.
It's exactly like a flask. That's exactly what it is. So I remember seeing a documentary on TV about iron workers were working in a big forge, a big foundry, and it was really, really hot. And they all wear thermal underwear under their clothes, like long johns and everything, because that helps to keep the heat from those furnaces from coming through to their skin. So that's feathers do the same thing. And we know that with some birds like geese, which we've been able to track for a bit longer because they're big birds, so heavier transmitters and heavier sensors can go onto them. We know that sometimes geese, when migrating, will actually fly into a headwind. You might think that that would be counterproductive because it's making it harder for them to fly. But the thinking is that their flight muscles, with all the flapping they're doing, it's generating so much heat in their body, they actually need that cold wind to cool them down. Otherwise, they would overheat and they could actually die.
Somebody who wears their long johns all the time is Dr. Richard Collins. He's in Malahide. Richard!
Derek, yes, very interesting discussion. I'm just thinking about it. Go back a few decades and we used to have a lovely goose in St. Stephen's Green. There was a flock of them, bar-headed geese. People who are a little older will remember them. Now, these things migrate between Russia and India over the Himalayas. They fly over the Himalayas, height of 8,000 metres. That's an enormous height. Now, consider what's happening when a bird starts migrating. It has a massive amount of fuel built up. And where does that fuel end up? It uses it to drive the flight muscles and it ends up as heat. So it is a warming system, an inherent, as Niall mentioned there, the winds are used to cool some birds when they fly. Well, there is an internal heating system. Now, why go up so high? Well, the winds can benefit you up there. Air resistance is much lower. You can cover greater distance for the same effort than you would lower down. So there's a lot of things working in your favour of going up very high. Now, the other thing mentioned is whether the birds actually land in the sea. Well, some whooper swans from Iceland take off in the evening. There was a limited amount of research done on this with trackers on them. Interestingly, what do they do when there's fog? They're visual birds. They look where they're going, sort of thing. And what if the fog comes down or mist or rain? Well, it was thought they flew very high. Actually, the ones that were tested tended to fly low over the sea. They didn't go up very high. But if it got foggy, they tended to land on the sea and wait around until it cleared before resuming their journey. So these are a case of birds which do land on the sea when they have to.
Of course, Richard, with the whooper swan, they're a very large bird, so they don't have to fear too much from predators when they're migrating. They can afford to fly down low. I know one of the theories about why some birds might migrate so high is that obviously it's much safer up there in terms of predators and also hazards like obstacles on the ground.
Just stay away from Nevada.
But that's one of the theories behind it. I think that as we get more sensors on birds, we're going to be really surprised by how high some of them are flying, the speeds and the journeys that some of them are doing. I mean, when you think of the endurance feats that some of these birds can do, if you look at the Arctic Tern, the world's greatest migrant, and we have them breeding here in Ireland. But it's now seen from these trackers, we knew they flew far, but it seems that some of them fly 80,000 kilometres each year, which is absolutely mind-boggling. And if you consider that those birds live for 20 or 25 years, the actual mileage they're racking up over the course of their lives, it's enormous. We're almost talking like the distances of space travel at this stage. And this is a small little bird weighing a few grams, you know, not much bigger than a blackbird. Really remarkable what they can do from a biological point of view. So I think that this, as we learn more about how they're regulating their body temperatures, how they regulate their breathing as well. Because, of course, we were saying at those high altitudes when birds are flying, there's very little by way of oxygen. I've been as high as 5,000 metres once in Central Asia, and I remember I would take two or three steps and feel like I had run a marathon. It's just you're breathing the air, it's doing nothing for you. Birds way higher than that, again, are flapping at full speed, using extreme stress on their muscles, and they're thriving. It's amazing.
But how can they do it?
We know that some birds have more hemoglobin in their blood, so they're more efficient at actually utilising the small amount of oxygen that is there. Also, birds are much more efficient at using the air than we are. They have air sacs around their body. They can store it in there. Their breathing is a lot more complicated than ours. But also, part of it's unknown. We don't know why they're quite so good at this. We do know that birds who migrate long distances, like the bar-tailed godwits, which Jim was mentioning earlier, when they migrate, we know that what happens is their internal organs actually atrophy. They won't be eating for several days, so they actually let their whole digestive systems just reabsorb into their body. Not completely, but a lot of that just disappears. Their reproductive organs start to disappear. Some of their other vital organs that they don't need for a couple of weeks, they'll actually reabsorb most of that, and all of that energy goes into flying. And then when they arrive at their final destination, of course, they are absolutely ravenous, and then everything starts to appear back as normal, and they just gorge themselves and get back into condition again. It's really amazing.
Bees, and worker bees, for instance, somebody worked out how far a worker bee flies in the 5 weeks or so that it lives, and the figure came up at around 800 kilometres, flying back and forth, collecting nectar and pollen. So if a small little thing like a bee can do that enormous distance, how much could a thing as big as a bird do? They look at things differently from us.
I fully agree with Richard on that. I think I've learned from learning all these things that the more we learn, the more we realise how little we actually know. And I think with the technology, which has been a thread running through the conversation, it's such an exciting time for people studying the birds and other creatures around us now, because the technology is improving and improving and improving. We're suffering a bit from, in our case, in our part of the world, it tends to be a Victorian approach, that the humans are at the top. We're the most intelligent. We're the most clever. We're big. We have the biggest brain, even though that's not the case, all this sort of thing, big being the best. And as we start drilling down into the lives of even the tiniest of creatures, we're discovering that something doesn't have to be big to be powerful, to be clever and intelligent, and to be able to withstand high altitudes and extremes of heat and all that sort of thing. I think what we're discovering now, I use the analogy of the mobile phone. When they came out first, remember that? They were the size of a telephone box. They were enormous things.
I remember them, yeah.
And now we're almost getting like Star Trek. They'll be just on your jacket, and you'll just tap it and talk. But what it is showing is what you can now put into the smallest mobile phone, like all the books in the National Library and all the libraries in Europe and that. We are discovering actually that small doesn't necessarily mean not as clever or is not as ingenious at surviving. And these are examples that we've been discussing. And this one with the great snipe, as I say, really caught my eye as another bit of the frontier of knowledge about birds being pushed out.
You're right, Jim. Now, we were talking earlier about the number of bird watchers there are in the world, and both Jim and you, Niall, said you would challenge me on that figure. That was a figure I found online. So I said there were 16 million bird watchers, or people who claim to be bird watchers, on the planet, and there are something like 10,000 birds. So that's one bird for every 1,600 people. So Niall Hatch, Richard Collins and Jim Wilson, do you agree with that figure? Start with you, Niall.
I don't agree with that figure, Derek. I don't know how anybody could possibly come up with an accurate figure, because I'm sure they haven't spoken to everybody in the world. But I would say that figure is very, very low. 16 million doesn't sound like a lot given the global population. I suppose it all comes down to, what do you define a birdwatcher as? Who is a birdwatcher? We know that in the United States, for example, about 60 million people feed birds in their back gardens, and they enjoy watching them and they get pleasure from doing that. Are they bird watchers? Some might say yes, some might say no. I would say arguably they are. Mm-hmm. We know here in Ireland that Birdwatch Ireland has 15,000 members, but there are a lot of people feeding birds and watching birds who aren't members of Birdwatch Ireland. Please do join us if you're listening. But we know that, that within Ireland, the people feeding birds, it's a very popular pastime. All across Europe it
and
is 15, as well.
15,000 members could be 15,000 families, and you multiply that by four, as I understand it.
Absolutely.
When you're selling newspapers and you're trying to get advertising and all that kind of stuff, and you say, well, then you multiply it by four, 20, 60,000 people, give or take.
It could well be, absolutely. And so we really don't know. But I think maybe the definition of what a birdwatcher is, maybe it's a very personal thing. Sometimes people don't want to think of themselves as being birdwatchers.
Why?
Well, I think that perhaps people think it's a bit nerdy. There's a stigma behind it. They don't want to associate
people
that way.
People embrace it, nerdism.
They do more
if
now,
that,
yeah.
If that is what the term is. People embrace being nerds nowadays. They love it. I'm a nerd. What are you? I'm a nerd. What are you a nerd of? I'm a nerd of this. I'm a nerd of that. I'm a nerd of the other.
Well, we were talking at the top of the program about how we all got interested in birds. And, you know, starting as a child seems to be a common theme for a lot of people, although you can start at any age, of course. But I remember being in school. I never really was that interested in sport and so on in school. I used to like watching birds. Whenever you had projects to do in primary school, I would always do them on birds. I always remember when I was in sixth class, Mr. White, who was my sixth class teacher, we had a class project to do on anything we wanted. And I decided I was going to do it on birds. And I ended up winning the prize in the class for this. I had these two volumes of scrapbooks all done with all this stuff. And what he said to me, he said was, I thought that was going to be really boring. I didn't think that anyone could possibly do a project on birds. And you filled two volumes and it was the best one that I saw. And what I learned from that too was there were a lot of other kids in the class who were interested in wildlife. But it wasn't something that was considered being cool or wasn't something that their peers really respected. So they kept it under wraps and then finally that will atrophy and die. You know, I think that when I go talking to schools, and you give school talks, and Richard and Jim have done this many times as well, there's always a kid down the back, the quiet one who doesn't want to speak during the actual presentation, who comes up to you at the end and they're full of questions, but they didn't want to put their head above the parapet. They didn't want to be ridiculed by their peers. And I think what's happening is these kind of nerdish pursuits. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, it's all about the pursuit of knowledge. It's rejoicing in the world and what makes us all tick. I think it's really fascinating. We're seeing that coming more to the fore. It's becoming perhaps more culturally and socially acceptable. And I think that if you did surveys asking people, are you a bird watcher, each year I think you'd see the number going higher and
growing
higher.
Growing and growing.
Because more people are willing to admit it.
So you concur with that, Jim, I take it?
Oh, 100%. Absolutely. I mean, when I give a talk or anything like that, and no matter where I've been, and I ask, you know, how many bird watchers in the audience? And you get about 4.5 hands going up. You get like one or two are very confident, and then there's ones kind of looking around wondering, is there anybody else going to put up their hand? And that feeds exactly into what Niall just said, that you know, actually admitting it, it's a bit like, you know, having an addiction in some respects, and you know, you're afraid to say it, that this is what you actually love to do. And then when I say to the same audience, have you ever watched a bird in your garden or when you were on holidays and wondered what it was doing? And I said, be honest, and everyone puts their hand up. So, I mean, I would contend that, depending on the definition, as Niall also said, almost everybody is a bird watcher. I think in the past, we were bird watchers even more because it was part of the survival mechanism. The arrival of spring, the arrival of winter, summer, was often, you know, signaled by the change in behaviour, the change in colour of the birds around us, things like that. And so... I think we're almost all bird watchers subconsciously, but maybe not to get into it as crazy as myself, Richard and Niall are, for example. But also I think we're coming up with the same sort of history, you know, the three of us, about being into something that wasn't that cool. And like that, I was into sport, but I just hadn't the physique for it, really. But what I feel, you know, why do we not teach in schools? And I think we are doing it a little bit more now from the days when we were at school. Things like beauty and amazement, being able to sit down and look at a flower up close or look at an insect up close and just be in wonder of how amazing that creature is, and the detail and the design and everything about it. I do believe that there are definitely more than 16 million. It's quite possible, Derek, this was, you know, a very narrow definition. You know, member of an organization, goes out at least twice a month, you know, records the number of birds. Yeah, if you start putting those kind of descriptors on what a bird watcher is, you're probably right. It is probably towards the 16 million. I still think it's a bit more than that, but I like to think of the bird watcher in the far more general term. People don't realize they actually are. I think,
but it's a bit like Eurovision fans. Nobody really wants to admit it.
Yeah, it is. But COVID-19 has really revealed a whole other side to people's attitudes and what they're interested in. And it's just gone through the roof in Ireland.
It has. And I mean,
the interest.
It's not scientific, but I can certainly tell you anecdotally that we've received more emails now than we have in the past 25 years. We certainly receive more photographs of wild creatures and mainly birds, because birds are what people can see. Isn't that true, Richard?
Yeah. Yeah, birds are like us. They're around during the day. We can see them. They sing and they resemble us in so many ways. We can always see a bird day or night, no matter where you are. There will be a bird around, unlike other creatures. Now, people, it is the great, and birds are the great entry into the natural history, into studies of the natural history. You become interested in birds and then you become interested in the things that birds eat and the things that eat birds, and the whole thing widens out. You can't study birds on their own. You have to take the whole world into account. They're all linked up, and it is a great way to start, and that is what's happening. I've been talking to children now for what, 50 years more. Nowadays, children are far more knowledgeable. Adults, too, are far more knowledgeable than they used to be long ago. Things are improving in this area of life. As the birds and the wildlife declines, interest in them increases among people. It's a strange paradox, but it's true.
Well, it's good. You talked about there feeding the birds and what the birds are feeding on. You have to take an interest in that. Now, you're all about handouts. Explain.
Yes, to feed or not to feed, Derek, that is the question.
Well, it's one of them.
Yeah, it is a big question, yes. There's a lot of criticism. Are birds becoming dependent on artificial food, the food we give them? Now, this always interested me because I studied swans, and one of the ways of trying to get swans near enough to read rings and so forth is to offer them bread, stale bread. Now, this bread is said to be harmful by some, but the interesting thing about it is the swans tended to get kind of addicted to the bread. Surrounded by sea lettuce and algae that they could eat, they would hang around and wait for the next car to arrive to eat bread rather than eat the good natural food for them. Now, I didn't worry about the swans, because when the weather turns bad and there's no cars and no bread, they have to revert to water weeds and so on and so forth. So, and they were all very healthy. So I wasn't worried about this. But the general notion of feeding birds, is this harmful? Does it do any harm? Now, it's easy to study swans. They're big and conspicuous. But songbirds and things are a different matter. Now, how do you gauge the effect of artificial feeding on songbirds? Well, now, the University of Oregon have published a paper. They used a strange research method. The bird, the equivalent of blue tits and cold tits in America, is the chickadee. That's what they call it. Chickadee is a tit. And the black-capped chickadee, which looks a bit like our cold tit, they decided they would test this hypothesis on chickadees. Now, what did they do? They did something which I would not like to do, I must admit. They caught a large number of chickadees and they clipped some of the long feathers of the wings. Now, the reason to do that was to not prevent the chickadees from flying, but to make it harder for them to fly. So then they set up 27 feeding stations, and each chickadee fitted with a device that registered if the chickadee visited a particular feeding station. They could measure then whether the ones with the handicap of slightly impaired feathers came more often than the ones with the full range feathers. Now, they expected that the ones that had a limited feather capacity would come more frequently. They would need more food, they thought, because of their difficulty getting around. But no, they discovered, in fact, that the birds that had full wings were no different from the birds that had clipped wings. They both visited to the same extent, and the clipped wing birds visited further away feeding stations just as well as others. Now, they have been concluded from this that birds, songbirds, do not become addicted to handouts, to artificial feeding. What do you think of that?
So it's good to give them. You think it's okay to feed the birds then? Is that what their conclusion is? If they don't get addicted, then you can give them food. It's only supplementary and it gets them through that little dry spell, so to speak. Is that what they're saying?
That is what they're saying. They say there is no evidence. They expected to find, I don't know what they expected, but the implication was they would find that the birds that had a slight handicap would become addicted to the artificial food. But that was not what happened.
Well, what I'd like to know is what happened to the birds that had the slight handicap. I mean, did they all survive or did they die? Did they perish? I mean, did they succumb to predation?
Well, that's the trouble. They do mention a previous paper, which was done some years ago, in which the breeding success of birds with clipped wings was compared with those without clipped wings. And that paper concluded that, in fact, there was no significant difference between the two groups. But it's an old paper, and you would worry about all the ifs, buts and caveats and statistical quirks and so on in it. This paper seems to suggest that there is no evidence, no evidence. Absence of evidence, Derek, isn't evidence of absence.
OK, remember. Let's ask Niall. From Birdwatch Ireland's point of view, Niall, you're the NGO responsible for making sure that the birds of Ireland are okay and that you're the ones who give out the information to your members. You should do this, you should do that, do it this time of year, do it that time of year. What do you say to your members? What do you say to the listening public? Is it okay to feed birds? Or are we putting them in danger of becoming addicted to our food source? And then when we take that away, then they're snookered.
First of all, to set down a marker on this, our position is absolutely feeding birds in your garden is a very good thing to do.
It's
a
great all year round?
You can do it all year round. Obviously, the autumn and especially the winter when the temperatures are lowest, that's the time it's the most beneficial to them. But even feeding during the summer, it's not a huge problem, although we do get a lot of people telling us the birds don't show anywhere near as much interest in the artificial food at that stage. So what we see from this is that the birds, as far as we can tell, don't really understand what's happening. They don't know that humans are putting this food out there for them. It's just another food source that they happen to come across. They're very resourceful, and what they do is their whole lives are in fact geared around seeking out sources of food that are reliable. So if they find peanuts or sunflower seeds and a feeder at your bird table, they'll think, oh, this is a wonderful natural source of food. And if that disappears, they'll go and find something else. So we do find that they do tend to cope quite well, even when the food is not there, except in the very harshest of conditions, because they're not aware that humans are putting it there for them. The other thing is that studies have shown that the birds are actually using the feeders less than you might think. Even in very cold weather, it still only makes up quite a small proportion of their overall daily diet. They must, we presume, get some sort of cravings within their bodies telling them what kind of food they need to eat. And they know that they need perhaps high protein insects or different kinds of seed. So very often what happens is that food in the gardens really just supplements them and really helps to just give them that extra boost. Now, having said that, we get a lot of people talking to us about helping the birds, really want to help them. We ask them, you know, can you help Birdwatch Ireland? Can you join us? And they say, well, what I do is I feed the birds in my garden. That's how I'm saving them. And it's really nice to do. It's a great way to learn more about them. But just bear in mind, of course, that the birds that are visiting your garden, the species that are doing that, they're probably the ones that are least in need of help. Blue tits and blackbirds and great tits and birds like that, they are super abundant. They're not in any conservation danger at the moment. And long may that continue. What happens is that the birds that kind of need the most help, they're not visiting people's gardens. They're out in our boglands or in our marshes or in our woodlands. So really, it can kind of skew things a bit. People don't realise that birds need a lot more help than just feeding them in the garden. That's not going to change our biodiversity crisis. It's not going to make a huge difference overall. But please do keep doing it. It's a great way to learn about them, particularly for children, and helping your local songbird population is a lovely thing to do. One of the things, though, that I'm getting quite interested in is the ethics behind the sources of food that you're using. Because different manufacturers and different companies use different sources for food. It's not very transparent. We don't necessarily know where they come from. But we do know that there's a lot of bird food grown in parts of South America and in parts of Asia, particularly in China. In some cases, it could be that deforestation is happening to plant these seed crops of sunflower seed or peanuts or whatever they may be to feed
Specifically for
feeding birds.
Is the business that big?
There's a lot of money in this. Well, we were talking about the number of bird watchers around the world. Mm. The number is certainly increasing, whatever that number is. And that's people, particularly in more affluent countries, feeding birds in their gardens. And we even have situations where it's been seen in Argentina, for example, where there's rare birds, they're called seed eaters. They're a bit like our finches. small little birds that eat seed, as their name would suggest. Some of those are very rare and very threatened. But there have been cases where people have been using nets to trap them, to keep them away from the lucrative seed crops that are then exported to Europe to feed the birds in our garden. We know that a lot of pesticides are sometimes used to grow peanuts for birds in China, and then these peanuts are exported to Europe. But the local birds, some of the rare buntings, are suffering as a result of that. So I think what's going to happen in the years to come, the focus on the provenance of bird food is going to become much more important. But people feed the birds because they want to help them. But ultimately, if that is hurting birds around the world and endangering some species indeed, that's maybe not a good thing at all. So I think that's something we need to look at. There needs to be more of a conversation around that. And the other thing, of course, as well, is that sometimes if feeders aren't properly maintained, or even if they are, but with bad luck, they can spread disease. So that's something we need to watch out for.
Well, we've seen this in Michigan and in New York. There was a story recently saying that please clean out your hanging feeders. There is a disease spreading amongst birds, and it's because of the dirty hanging feeders.
Yes, because of course the pathogens can spread through those. And I think we humans have learned a lot, just in the general public, about pathogens and about pandemics and so on because of our own experience with COVID. These kind of diseases run rampant in wild bird populations. And of course, when birds concentrate at a feeder, this is an opportunity for these diseases to jump between species that normally wouldn't have interacted with each other. We know what this disease in North America, it seems to have some sort of neurological effect on the birds. They're behaving in a dazed, stunned kind of way. Sometimes they just seem to be just zoned out. It's very, very strange. Here in Ireland and in other parts of Europe, we've seen a problem with another disease called trichomoniasis, which is spreading through bird feeders, and it affects finches very badly. Most birds seem to be immune to it, but finches, and particularly green finches, are badly affected, to the extent now that the green finch is on the red list in Ireland. A garden bird that just a decade ago was really common, fewer and fewer of them being seen, and big part of this is
something like red list. Niall, will you just qualify what you mean?
Yes, so the red list, of course, is the traffic light system that's used to show the threat level to different birds. So you think of traffic lights, you have red, amber and green. So red is the birds that are in most in danger, so are endangered species, shall we say. You have then amber, which is a medium threat level, showing signs for concern. And then you have the green list, which are the birds that for the moment seem to be secure and aren't giving cause for concern. They're reviewed every 5 or 6 years, and it was really astonishing to see that the green finch now has moved to the red category, so the highest level of threat, because of this disease that's affecting them at the bird feeders.
All right, so let's finish on a positive, shall we?
Good idea.
Niall, we've heard from Jim and we've heard from Richard. They brought us their offerings to the table. Jim was talking about Harper's Island and the migratory birds, and he spoke about the snipe and how high it's been recorded flying. Richard started the debate about handouts, should we or shouldn't we feed the birds? And now you want to talk about rockabills. You mentioned the Arctic tern earlier. We want to talk about the roseate tern and why rockabill just off the coast of North County Dublin is so important and what kind of year it's had to date.
We followed the story of Rockabill Island for a long time on Mooney Goes Wild. We've been out talking to the wardens and who are out there each year working with Birdwatch Ireland, funded by the National Parks and Wildlife Service, and big thanks to the Commissioners of Irish Lights as well for the work they do there. Rockabill Island, the Tern Conservation Project there, is now one of the big conservation success stories around Europe. Rockabill Island is home to the largest European breeding colony of roseate terns, a really beautiful seabird, a highly migratory bird that spends the winter off the coast of West Africa. And over the years, what's happened there, largely due to my colleague Steve Newton and the great effort he's done there with the wardens, they've got that population from being virtually extinct, there's very low numbers of birds, up to now being a powerhouse for this species, populating now other colonies around Europe with the numbers. And I'm delighted to say that this year we've had the largest recorded number of roseate tern pairs nesting there ever. There's over 1,700 pairs of roseate terns on Rockabill Island. The numbers went down as low as just over 100 pairs around 30 years ago. And from then we've gone up from this steady base, slowly growing each year, year on year. And it's been really remarkable. So our three wardens are out there this summer. We've spoken to Emma Tiernan out there on the programme as well, and she's been filling us in this year. And it's been remarkable that the nesting success has been great. So I know there's a lot of doom and gloom when we talk about conservation. I'm always talking about how bad things are going. When it comes to our roseate terns, they're doing really well.
And Ireland is really in the forefront of this.
Yeah, yes, it's something that gets a lot of attention abroad from other conservation organisations.
But not enough here in Ireland.
Not enough here in Ireland. We should be really proud of this.
And we are.
The thing is that the lessons that we're learning on Rockabill, how to, Steve Newton, what he's done is he's worked out how do you produce roseate terns. How do you make them happy? So roseate terns.
Explain what the situation was first and what he did and how it's had an impact on that population.
So Rockabill Island, it's a remote island off the coast of Skerries.
And it's two islands, Rock and Bill, but they're right beside each other.
Yeah, they're right beside each other. And so there's a lighthouse keeper's house on there. And it's apart from that, there's very little habitable area on the island. It's really small and most of it's just this rocky surface. It's fairly sparsely vegetated, although there are some areas where you have a plant called tree mallow that grows up. This is a big sort of leafy green plant with lovely pinky purple flowers. And because of all the natural fertilizer from the bird droppings there, it grows really rapidly. And so what happens every year, Steve and the wardens have to go out there, they have to cut back some of that, not all of it, but you have to make sure that there's enough space to allow the birds to come in and land on the ground below that. But you need some of it because roseate terns like to nest with cover over their heads. And they're also very picky. They don't like to nest by themselves. They want to nest in a colony that already has other tern species in it. So we now know that you can't expect a colony of roseate terns to arrive. You have to make sure that other terns are there first. You need common and or Arctic terns there. So we actually have traditionally more common tern pairs nesting on the island than Arctic terns and roseate terns. Arctic tern number is actually going down, which is a bit of a worry, but the common terns and the roseate terns are doing well. The reason why that is, why the roseate terns need them, is those other two species are much more aggressive. So when danger in the form of a predator comes to the island, be it a human or a gull or a mink or something like that, they will attack it and peck at it and try to drive it away. The roseate terns are a bit shyer. They won't do that. So they benefit from the protection of their neighbours. And so we realise this. So what you do is you try help the common terns, first of all. And then you might need to make sure that you have proper nesting cover for the roseate terns. So that could be this tree mallow plant, but also wooden nest boxes work very well. So now there are hundreds upon hundreds of wooden nest boxes all over the island. We have to take them in at the end of every season and then put them back out the following year. We replace a few hundred each year because of natural weathering away of them. And what happens is then the roseate terns will nest inside those boxes. And this shelters their chicks and their eggs from the elements and from the rain. And the other terns that nest are the commons and the arctics, they never ever use the boxes. It seems they just can't compute, doesn't compute, they won't go into them, but the roseate terns will. And this has greatly increased their productivity, which means the number of chicks per pair that are surviving. And this is how you keep them going. You need to make sure that there's enough there to replace their parents ultimately in the population. And if you even just have just a fraction above that level, the population will continue to grow. Luckily, terns are long-lived species. They can easily live for 20 years. So they can handle a few bad years in a row. If there's a big storm or something that the eggs chill and they die off and it's a bad year, that's okay. Because if they have a good year every 4 or 5 years, then the population will continue to increase. And really, that's what we've done. And now, because of the expertise that's been built up on Rockabill, we're now able to consult with other people doing conservation projects for this species around Europe and around the world. And this has led to a great increase in the species now in places like Coconut Island in England, the Skerries Islands off Wales, in Brittany, in the Azores as well, other places now where the roseate tern colonies are growing and expanding because of the work that we've pioneered on Rockabill. And not just that, we know that some of the birds that themselves hatched out on Rockabill are now going and visiting these other European colonies and are now laying there because they recognise what nest boxes are. They see the same design of nest box and they think, that's where I can breed. And so that's why it's been so successful. So hats off to everyone involved. It's been great.
Well, congratulations to all of the team on Rockabill at this moment as we speak, and to Birdwatch Ireland for that work. And thanks to Richard Collins. Richard, thank you very much indeed. It was very interesting listening to you guys talking about birds. Did you enjoy it?
We did indeed, and all sorts of ideas and things to stimulate further thought and controversy. Wonderful, Derek. This is what we need. Lots of talk.
This is what we need, I agree. Jim Wilson and Cove. Jim.
Yeah, Derek, it's been fantastic. I mean, we talk about birds quite a bit on the programme over the years, but just to have the full time and to get into a little bit more detail, and it's been fantastic, really, really enjoyable, fantastic.
Jim, thank you very much indeed, and thanks also to Niall Hatch indeed for coming in. That's all we have time for today. If you want to listen back to the programme or any of our programmes, you'll find a very extensive audio archive on our website, which is rte.ie/Mooney. Until next week, goodbye.